are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
This is Intelligence Aboriginal Radio, Angry Indian Radio for the Fourth World.
Internet radio for smarter,
good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, Angry Indian, editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com. You have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neoclassist, neocolonialist, neoliberal, and neofascist control. I wish you all welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. Shout out to all the gods and earths and peace to the risen family at this time of struggle. Today we're speaking to Sashnan. He is a member of the Aboriginal News Group, and you can always find his work on sashnan.com, and you can check him out at Bedlam Fury on Twitter. That's how we met, and he is one of the international bloggers that deals with HIV and AIDS and other health issues as they pertain to indigenous people in his part of the world, representing Malaysia. And we're going to talk about these issues and a couple other things that pop up. Please stick around. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Radio.
Service. I'll be talking into your heart, into your head, in just a few moments. All I want you to do is just lend me your ear for the time that we will be together.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Absolutely convinced that this nation is finally headed in the right direction. Our economy is growing again. We are adding jobs again. America's moving forward again.
President Obama wants $50 billion to create jobs for construction of roads, railways, and runways. Already, billions have been committed in new initiatives such as Social Innovation Fund, economic stimulus, and broadband. And hundreds of millions are going to border security. Yet, security and jobs for whom? Construction jobs mostly employ men, the new funding initiatives have principally benefited institutions and government, and border security seems to be for U.S. transnationals operating maquilas and those seeking to profit from the violence and poverty in Ciudad Juarez and Mexico. But what about security and jobs for women workers on the U.S.-Mexico border? Why invest in infrastructure benefiting transnational corporations and not in community-led development? For nearly two decades, first with NAFTA and now with the war on drugs, border women have seen their livelihoods, communities, and futures written off as unfortunate but necessary casualties by the companies they made rich, left to live and die amidst the underdevelopment of the border. Yet, women have refused to accept this fate. Organized, fierce, and resilient, they're pursuing their own version of security and employment. La Mujer Obrera in El Paso is one example. Through their daycare, restaurant, festival marketplace, museum, media center, and adult education programs, the women are creating genuine border security, real economic development. And they have extensive plans for additional development, including schools, housing, and health programs. Like La Mujer Obrera, there are other low-income women on the border who have the vision and drive needed to create spaces where cultural arts and grassroots microenterprises can flourish, restoring economy, pride, and dignity in their neighborhoods. Their efforts are the stuff that economists, feminists, and reformers tout as vital to build sustainable national security and development. Yet today, the women find themselves fighting their hardest battle yet, sustainability in the weakest U.S. economy in decades, and a future being designed without them. Local and national media have focused on border violence and security issues, but have missed the solutions that border women are ready to implement. Public-private initiatives need to prioritize border women's efforts to restore their communities from the damaging effects of international trade policies. As Gloria Steinem said when she visited La Mujer Obrera, there is no safe space for women. We have to create that space. We have to build that community. The conditions of women on the border are urgent, and women on the border are demanding justice and equity now. For more information, contact La Mujer Obrera.
And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower of a TV. You know, TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, there's one
terrible president. The only video we've been told exists of the plane flying into the first tower spent the entire day in the videographer's camera at ground zero. So what video did Bush see?
It's under attack.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian, and we're speaking today to Sashnan from Malaysia. He's a member of the Aboriginal News Group, and we're going to talk about a few issues that relate to the indigenous people in his area of the world, and of course, anything that, you know, all of the issues that are important to all of us. I mean, we're in a time of war. We're in a time of confusion. We're in a time right now where religion is being used as, again, it's not as if this is a new thing. It's a cast-sized belly that separates the West from the rest of the world. And, you know, we're having a lot of issues, and we're not having a lot of understanding. So we're going to talk to Sashnan today about things. And he's in a part of the world where there's a lot of change going on right now. When we turn to think of Southeast Asia and the West, we always tend to think of Vietnam and the Philippines. We forget about Indonesia. We forget about Malaysia. You know, and we forget that there are indigenous people living there trying to get on day to day, and that there are ethnic conflicts that many of us are not aware of. And we're questioning, why is not the United Nations, why is the international community not paying attention to what is happening to the indigenous people in these communities? And we're going to get into this right now. Sashnan, welcome to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thank you, brother. Thanks a lot. It's a very humid night in Malaysia, and I'm really, really honored to be speaking to you.
Okay, so let's just jump into this. Politically, in terms of everything I was talking about leading in terms of health, in terms of political freedom, and how that relates to health, the indigenous communities and the other ethnic groups that live in your country. What is the state of affairs right now for the average person in Malaysia?
When it comes to the human rights aspect of Malaysian, the problem is actually the human rights mentality is at its infancy. More than 50 plus years ago, Malaysia obtained independence from the British. But the question is Malaysia truly independent? Is it managed by the people, and are Malaysians from all walks of life and from different ethnic groups involved in governance? And naturally, with the recent Bersih 3.0 rally that happened about a month ago, many Malaysians are asking themselves, what do they want to see in their future as a society that supposedly believes in harmony and acceptance, or what the government would say, tolerance rather than acceptance. So in many aspects of a Malaysian life, is there's still a big question mark to what would they want to see for them, for themselves and for their families, for their neighbours, for their tribes and for their communities. Naturally, their concern is on the economics of the country, jobs, employment, and of course issues around homelessness and urbanisation. Jobs play an important part in the everyday Malaysian. Malaysians are always looking at the fastest way to make money to survive. Poverty rate is still relatively small according to the government, yet the concern from social activists would, and many NGOs would be centered on despite the vast natural resources that Malaysia possess and the incredible wealth and the spending spree that it has on military toys, why is it that the small community of poor people, for example rural poor, are not looked into? Why are their issues neglected? Why are they still in this cycle of poverty? So and of course Bersih looks into the issue of the free election. And free election is important because it would determine whether the political dynasty is able to sustain itself or not. There must be change, and for me, there must be a complete independence of from any form of oppression, whether especially on institutionalized violence. So, health-based issues, society-based concerns, and of course, economical needs play an important role in a Malaysian's life. Whether the person is on the street, or whether the person is working in a corporate job, or whether the person is in attached with a government or an NGO, it is very common to find Malaysians holding or juggling more than two jobs at a time. And income issues on income is a priority for many Malaysians, primarily because of the high cost of living. Global recession, regional recession affects the market, but for many who believe in the government, they see more of a stabilization of the economics in Malaysia. Recession has officially not touched Malaysia's shores, and of course the lack of opportunities for Malaysians to participate in democratic decision making processes. For example, the person on the street, whether the person is homeless or the person is working in a blue collar industry, whether that person has a voice in the government. Many Malaysians would find well, in many, many countries also it's the same, but many Malaysians would see their member of parliament, the MPs, to be court jesters, clowns for the institution. Representation of the average Joe out there is debatable. Thus, the voices of the people are not represented by credible or trustworthy individuals. They're represented by an opposition or by the pro-government institutions that believes in their own agenda, political agendas. To a large extent, Malaysia is boiling when it comes to issues of human rights. Malaysians are unable to grasp their counterparts from Indonesia, from Thailand, on issues of human rights, in the issues of living in a society free of prejudice and oppression. Malaysians prefer the good old Malaysian way, which is to conduct dialogues, to talk and to debate. But there's no real change. Why? Because the system is flawed. The system is prepared by the institution. The institution encourages such a dialogue and keeps the minorities busy with dialogues, and thus issues around unemployment, issues around healthcare, issues around institutionalized violence, which we all saw in during Bersih 3, and issues around education are usually neglected. Very common that you will see from the mainstream media there is an absence of a fundamental voice of individuality. Why? Because the culture in Southeast Asia is requires that one conforms to the traditions and the supposedly best practices of society. Rebels and recalcitrants are not encouraged in many societies in Southeast Asia. They are seen as treasonous individuals or communists, which is a common word in Malaysia. If you are against the institution for issues around religion, whether you or you debate on the issues of ethnicity and or land rights issues, then you're considered a communist. But this is quite prevalent in Indonesia. It's also more than 4 decades ago. And of course, in Thailand, whereby those who go against the institution are considered Marxist or communist. I have no problems with the ideologies. But all I care is that democratic process of decision making, which is a fundamental value of democracy, but that is absent, to a large extent absent, on many issues in Malaysian politics or in Malaysian society.
All right, well, let me ask you, having said all of that, how does this relate to the various indigenous nations? Because I prefer not to use tribe unless they really identify themselves as such. But for the First Nations in Malaysia, and for what became Malaysia, because who recognized or formed what we understand in terms of borders, what Malaysia is now, that's separated from Indonesia, separated from the Philippines, is separated from Java.
I think in terms of the indigenous people and many in Borneo, which is Sabah and Sarawak, do not mind associating with the word tribe, but many indigenous people in Malaysia, which is indigenous people, whether in Borneo or in Peninsula, do not recognize borders. And by the identity, and then is respected and protected in accordance to the constitution. Respected only among a small minority, unfortunately. When it comes to the identity, it's quite superficial. In fact, it's on paper. In practice, it is not. The indigenous people are, for example, the Orang Asli community. Which is about 100 over 1,000 individuals in a population of 28 million people, extremely small number, and they possess very little influence, political influence, to sustain or to actively protect their rights. So you will see a lot of corporations, businesses, you see a lot of individuals, you see a lot of politicians manipulating the system or the ignorance of the system to rob indigenous people of their rights towards their land, towards their way of life. Way of life meaning related to education, related to an identity where one can safely call oneself as Orang Asli or Orang Asal. Orang Asal is actually for Borneo, Sabah and Sarawak, and Orang Asli is referred to as indigenous people in Peninsula Malaysia. And the challenge is actually the wide level apathy or ignorance of the Malaysian society pertaining to the constitution and the laws. Because of this, Orang Asli communities are expected to conform to the civilization or the civilized behavior of and that's, and I'm saying that in a sarcastic way, of society at large, which comprises of the Malay community. The Malay community, or what the even in Indonesia they would say Orang Melayu, so there's a sense of sense of conformity. You must conform to the way of life, which is the Melayu way or the Malay way. If not, you will not enjoy the fruits of freedom. You will not enjoy the fruits of democracy. These are very oppressive mentality, and society's mentality plays an important part in determining how politicians advocate whatever issues. So when society is completely ignorant and or chooses to embrace apathy, naturally politicians do not care about indigenous people. Half-hearted attempts of putting Orang Asli in the government has failed miserably. Why? Because, for example, the agency that's responsible for looking after the Orang Asli people, which is an agency directly in the Prime Minister's department, has completely failed in terms of empowering Orang Asli community to be part and parcel of the solution. They are seen, Orang Asli are instead seen as lazy, uneducated barbarians or nomads. And despite the resources that are available, many of the Orang Asli still live in a society, live in a culture where their own identity are lost, or their own identity and their own heritage are not accepted. I would say that ignorance plays a role, and it does influence government's decision. But I would also say that because of the small population of Orang Asli in Peninsula, that the Orang Asli's issues and concerns, for example, land rights, are not highlighted, are not prioritized, and are not given back to us.
Where exactly is Malaysia in terms of dealing with its indigenous people and dealing with poor Malaysians who, as you say, you know, poverty, according to the official statistics, are down, but people are working two, often three jobs and other side things that may not necessarily be healthy for society in order to make ends meet in terms of, say, like the sex trade. You know, I mean, how many women are involved in the sex trade? Not because they want to be, but because they really don't have much of a choice under the current... I mean, would you consider the Malaysian economy to be capitalist?
Yes. Yeah. Completely capitalist.
Completely capitalist.
I would think that when it comes to the economics of it, there is a somewhat bias... official policy that of the government and of society that states that Malays would get extra benefits pertaining to whether one wants to buy a house or in terms of education, in terms of securing a contract from the government. So it's very race-based economics. Capitalism is infused with ethnicity. You will get somewhere if you are a Malay, for example, or if one needs to start a livelihood project, you need to have a Malay to make it successful, to sustain it, for example. Sustainable development is encouraged with the participation of the Malay community in the governance of a business entity, for example. So there is a biasness towards race. There's also the whole problem of the rich getting richer and the poor are neglected. It's also, in my opinion, the poor are kept poor to ensure the caste system is maintained. The caste system is not just centered on the Indian population or the Indian Empire. The caste system is virtually alive in Malaysia, whereby if you are poor, you will be born poor, and you will work in a poor job, and you will live your life, the rest of your life, poor. How many people, for example, a 24-year-old man who comes from the village, his father has done so much, his parents have done so much to help him and on his education, and he's considered in his village to be extremely successful in terms of his education, the desire to be somebody, and of course passionately believing that he can get a job, and he with his degree he can get a job, and he will remove his family from poverty or absolute poverty, and he will make sure he will look after them. And the moment he goes to a city, for example in Kuala Lumpur, how many young men like him or women would be able to get a suitable job, suitable income? People with no connections will be given low paying jobs or jobs that they are not prepared for. For example, you studied microbiology and you get a degree for it, and you go to the city and you become the restaurant manager of a fast food chain, and discrimination practices is quite common in Malaysia, and it's widely accepted in that sense. Well, not accepted, but tolerated. Why? Because for decades, people have been living in a system that is not functioning, that it clearly is biased. But yet, you must understand that Southeast Asians, or mainly just Malaysians, are very passive in nature pertaining to what has been stipulated in tradition. So, caste system is actually one of the main corruption of values. It is actually, in fact, accepted. So if you're in the village and you decide to move to the city, there are a lot of challenges you have to go through. So it is quite common that government servants, for example, as people working in the government, they would actually find extra jobs like driving taxis, or selling at the night market, selling goods, food, or operating during the weekend a restaurant, a small street-based restaurant. So in terms of the caste system, that is a flaw. It's deeply ingrained in the mentality of many Malaysians, and I'm not discriminating against any one particular one. I would say all Malaysians would have experienced or would have practiced some form of discrimination or possess some prejudice of the other person because of the skin of the color of his skin. No. So in terms of another issue that you brought up is the issues of sex work. or prostitution. I think the issue would be the main issue for me, and I've worked with sex workers since 1996, and the issue would be not on health-based issues. The main issues would be on gender biasness, how we treat the opposite sex. The issue I would not even associate sex trafficking with prostitution, because they're completely different issues. But in the average Malaysian, well, actually the Malays, need to overcome their gender biasness. Whether the gender biasness stems from religion or tradition, or their own character defects of the supremacy of men, for example, there is a clear problem on issues and respect of women. So I think the issue of sex work is a debatable issue in whether it's right or wrong, or whether it's I have no problems with issues of women who are confident of their bodies, or men who are confident of their bodies, or transgender who are confident of their bodies, and whatever one does with one body is one's right. But the element of respect whereby domestic abuse, high cases of domestic abuse, should be more of a priority. How Malaysian men view transgender, transsexuals, how Malaysian men view women, and how view women view men is also an issue in Malaysia. So issues around domestic abuse, issues around incest, rape, should be placed as at a top priority compared to any cases of stigma and prejudice towards sex workers. But then, for the record, despite the presence of religion, despite the presence of vast amount of tradition in Malaysia, women are still being beaten on a weekly basis. Now, this is coming from a society that believes in harmony. This is a society that has gone to the North Pole, that has sent people to Western universities, and coming from a society that is completely rich in resources and experiences. There is a severe problem in terms of prejudice. I think in many of the problems that I've not mentioned is also connected to prejudice of Malaysians and of course how Malaysians view in this aspect, how Malaysians view orang asli. They are not treated as a Malaysian, number one. Number two, the rights of an indigenous person are not respected. The rights are acknowledged, but the identity and the heritage are not respected. In terms of activism or advocacy for the rights of marginalized indigenous people, there have been many cases of migration of indigenous folks in Peninsula Malaysia going to urban settings, cities, and are homeless, poor mental health, and possess very little resources to efficiently sustain themselves in living in a city, and this is sad because it's a yearly problem, a migration of young people from rural areas, whether it's from the plantations, whether it's from fishing villages, or it's from the indigenous folks, the tribes and the communities in the jungles. They come seeking to regain a bit of money to be part and parcel of society, to fulfill their young dreams, but then within a few months they are completely disillusioned because of issues around racism, issues around stigma, issues around the fact that that is very difficult for rural-based young people to adapt to urban setting. So it's Malaysia, I guess, faces a lot of challenges similar to many other countries, but at the same time it is unique because of our small population and our ability to send someone to space and buy submarines and many, many toys of war, and yet we can't spend much money to help a small community of indigenous people amounting to 130,000 individuals, which is extremely small in a population of Brunei. The resources are either abused, neglected, and not efficiently distributed or dispersed to indigenous folks. And I just want to set this myth of resources that are available by the government, by the Malaysian government. Indigenous folks do not want the money. We do not want these resources. We don't want special treatment. We just want our rights to be respected. We want our heritage to be remembered. And we want a continuation of a synergy of our heritage with society. Civilization, Malaysian civilization, is completely redundant. We are treated like barbarians. We are treated like animals. The reality is, when an orang asli or orang asal from Borneo comes to KL, there's a vicious cycle of prejudice because of how we are, the way we talk, the slang in our language, and of course our faith, our own faith, our right to our faith or our religion or our belief. And in that aspect, money is irrelevant, insignificant. Protect our rights, that's what we want. Mm-hmm. Protect our health so that our children will grow up being part and parcel of Malaysia, being part of the solution, but ostracized, not marginalized. And no matter how much money the government or institutions or NGOs throw at indigenous folks, money cannot buy heritage, money cannot buy respect. And these millions that apparently have gone to indigenous funds are not well utilized, primarily because governance is not about indigenous participation. Governance is about non-indigenous participation. Governance of the project, governance over anti-poverty or poverty eradication programs. Just because we live in huts and we live in the jungles does not mean that we need a bungalow in the city. We are more than happy to have whatever we have, that we have, and we've been doing this for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before anyone has come to our shores. So I think in that aspect, governance, fund disbursement, issues around community sustainability or community development, I think majority of Malaysians forget, whether it's health-based issues, whether it's rights-based, human rights, whether it's the right for our children to have access to clean drinking water. I think Malaysians always assume that it is about money. When there is money, the orang asli and the orang asal they will keep quiet when there is money. But that's not true. That's not true. So I think prejudice, stigma, discrimination plays a very critical role in how society as a whole views itself and views other people, especially people from marginalized backgrounds or ostracized, who are ostracized because of their ethnicity.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a break. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We're speaking to Sash Nan from Malaysia. He is a member of the Aboriginal News Group. You can find his blog at sashnan.com, and you can find him on Twitter at Bedlam Fury on Twitter. We're going to take a short break so stations may identify themselves. This is the Angry Indian. You are listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Thanks to the God Job Born Intelligence, Sudan. I'm up here in Master now, the God King in our rule. I want y'all to know how the black man came into existence through the knowledge. In the beginning, there was no beginning. In the darkness was the mind, the highest form of energy in the universe inside of the atom. Protons, electrons, and neutrons radiate, so out of darkness came light in the form of intelligence. See, first was the word, and the word was G-O-D. The light wanted to exist, so it said to itself be. So the A-T-O-M, a law of the original man, used the light to transform into matter to manifest. From molecule, cells, organs, tissues, and flesh. So now you see God, his arm, leg, leg, arm, head, who absorbed all things in the universe after he dealt with Islam, for I stimulate life and matter. I self, Lord and Master, wanted to show and prove, born the sun and nine planets to use as a tool. Then he looked at the earth and he measured his home and took solid liquids and gas and made him a woman. And said, let us make man in our likeness and our image. From the womb of the woman came forth black children. And they populated the earth or the land and the sea. And the children reached to the ground and formed Adam and Eve.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution.
62% want creation science taught along with evolution in our schools.
44% want creation science taught exclusively.
You are all about to learn that you didn't come from monkeys and slime. All of you were created in the image and likeness of God.
But didn't we evolve from prior organisms?
Yes, we did. Those organisms were named Adam and Eve.
Then why do we share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees?
The Bible doesn't teach about chimpanzees.
What about redundant DNA, a junk DNA? Does the Bible teach about that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's no redundant DNA in hell.
Our children are our future.
Let's try not to turn them into dangerous idiots.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
I lost my son,
my nephew,
my uncle,
my son
on September 11, 2001.
Most people don't know that a third tower fell on September 11.
World Trade Center 7, a 47-story skyscraper, was not hit by a plane.
Although the official explanation is that fire brought down Building 7,
over 1,200 architects and engineers have looked into the evidence
and believe there is more to the story.
Bring justice to my son,
my uncle,
my nephew,
my son.
Go to buildingwhat.org.
Why it fell, why it matters, and what you can do.
Hello, I am Susan Aglukkaq. The North has the highest incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, in the country. We also have a high rate of teenage pregnancies. High-risk behaviors, unprotected sex, lead to the spread of HIV/AIDS. It can be prevented. Learn the ways to protect yourself and others. Knowledge is power.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
ಬರುತ್ತಿದೆ ಎಲ್ಲಡೆ ಭೀಕರವಾಗಿ ಏಡ್ಸು ಏಡ್ಸು ಏಡ್ಸೋ ನಮ್ಮ ವೈರಿಗೂ ಬಾರದಿರಲಿ ಅದು ಓಡ್ಸು ಓಡ್ಸು ಓಡ್ಸೋ
ಹೆಚ್ಚಿನ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ಸಂಪರ್ಕದ ಸೋಂಕುಗಳು ವಾಸಿಗುತ್ತವೆ ಆದರೆ ಏಡ್ಸ್ಗೆ ಚಿಕಿತ್ಸೆ ಇಲ್ಲ
ಏಡ್ಸ್ಗೆ ತುತ್ತಾಗಿರುವ ವ್ಯಕ್ತಿಗಳಿಗೆ ನಿಮ್ಮಿಂದ ಬೇಕಾಗಿರುವುದು ಭೇದ ಭಾವ ಉಪೇಕ್ಷೆಯಲ್ಲ ಅವರಿಗೆ ಅಗತ್ಯವಿರುವುದು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಪ್ರೀತಿ ಅನುಕಂಪ ಮತ್ತು ಬೆಂಬಲ
ಕಾಂಡಮ್ ಅಥವಾ ನಿರೋಧ ಬಳಕೆ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ಸಂಗಾತಿಗಳ ಸಂಖ್ಯೆ ಹೆಚ್ಚಷ್ಟು ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ತಗುಲುವ ಅಪಾಯವೂ ಹೆಚ್ಚುತ್ತದೆ ಒಂದು ಪಕ್ಷ ನಿಮಗೆ ಎಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ಇದೆ ಎಂದು ಗೊತ್ತಾದರೆ ನಿಮ್ಮ ಆರೋಗ್ಯವನ್ನು ಕಾಪಾಡಿಕೊಂಡು ಹೋಗಲು ನಿಮಗೆ ಮತ್ತು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಕುಟುಂಬದವರಿಗೆ ಸ್ವಯಂ ಪ್ರೇರಿತ ಸಮಾಲೋಚನೆ ಮತ್ತು ಪರೀಕ್ಷಾ ಕೇಂದ್ರದವರು ಸಹಾಯ ಮಾಡುವರು
ಚಿಕಿತ್ಸೆಗೊಳಗಾಗದ ಲೈಂಗಿಕ ರೋಗಗಳಾದ ಯೋನಿಯ ಸ್ರಾವ ಮತ್ತು ಗಾಯ ಹುಣ್ಣು
ಕಿಬ್ಬೊಟ್ಟೆಯಲ್ಲಿ ನೋವು ಮತ್ತು ಸಂಭೋಗದ ಸಮಯದಲ್ಲಿ ನೋವುವಿರುವ ಸ್ತ್ರೀಯರಿಗೆ ಹೆಚ್ಐವಿ ಸೋಂಕು ತಗುಲುವ ಅಪಾಯ ಹೆಚ್ಚು.
ಏಡ್ಸ್ ಬಾರದಂತೆ ತಡೆಗಟ್ಟಲು ನೀವು ನಿಮ್ಮ ಸಂಗಾತಿ ಇಬ್ಬರಲ್ಲೂ ಪರಸ್ಪರ ವಿಶ್ವಾಸ, ಪ್ರೀತಿ, ನಿಷ್ಠೆ ಇರಲಿ. ನಿಮ್ಮದು ಏಕಪತಿ ಮತ್ತು ಏಕಪತ್ನಿತ್ವ ಸಂಬಂಧವಾಗಿರಲಿ.
Do yourself a favor, get a mind transplant, listen to independent radio, the alternative media in general. This is Ward Churchill saying have a nice day.
Listen to Angry Indian Radio. He is not only for Indians, but he is also for blacks and other minorities. And they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks. And so I recommend that you listen to them.
Internet radio for smart aboriginals.
This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome back. We're speaking still with Sashinan from Malaysia, member of the Aboriginal News Group, and the editor of Sashinan.com, the daily news in Malaysia. We've been talking about a hell of a lot of issues in terms of what's happening in Southeast Asia, and especially in his particular country. And what we're going to get into right now is one of the subjects that I have actually promised listeners that I would talk about more, and I haven't, only because I really don't feel justified, and that is only coming from me. But Sashinan is actually still out there in the field, and he's working with his people and trying to reduce the transmission to sexual I remember them as STDs. Now we know them as STIs, sexually transmitted infections. I'm not going to say that it's a minor issue because it isn't, but it is an issue because for nations, especially nations who have what we like to call here in the West socialized medicine, it is a drain on the system. And when you have a privatized system of health care or health maintenance, or health, whatever you want to call it, because it's not really making people healthy. We're talking about a consistent revolving door of patients that are not getting well, of cures that really don't work, and you have designer drugs now and what have you. And when it comes to HIV and AIDS, which, you know, we like to, you know, categorize still falsely as a gay disease, when we tend to forget that this disease sprouted in Africa, as we understand it, if we go by the information, you know, that we are being told. And I'm not going to get into conspiracy theories this particular show, even though I do believe that some of them are valid, at least in terms of starting a discussion. But right now we're going to, you know, talk about resources and whether or not in Malaysia resources are really being used, really being expended, especially when we're talking in terms of the cultural issues, in, you know, in terms of the religion, in terms of tradition, you know, in terms of how, as our guest has mentioned earlier, how women are treated and viewed, and how minorities and how immigrants are treated and viewed. And he brought up something here that I also did not get into in terms of the separation of prostitution in terms of sex trade, because we tend to think in the West that they're one and the same. And I've said enough, Sashinan, you know, let's break this down. In terms of this illness, a lot of people who are not indigenous do not understand that this particular syndrome, AIDS, as we understand it, affects indigenous people very, very seriously. We don't have access to adequate medical care as it is. We don't have access to adequate education on these issues. We don't have access to the politicians who make the decisions on where resources are allocated and so on. You know, from your standpoint on the ground dealing with this, what is happening?
It's very difficult for us to obtain statistics from the government or from NGOs in relation to how many indigenous people are living with HIV. Statistics are held by the government, and of course NGOs who have done their operations, their projects are also very hesitant in talking about indigenous people and those living with HIV or affected by HIV. I think the change can happen in areas of participation. The more the marginalized communities are able to participate in democratic decision making pertaining to the direction or the strategies of HIV/AIDS programs, we will see more positive change. I think the key element in working on HIV issues since 96, I've noticed that behavioral change is the key element. It is behavioral change of an individual, whether the person is HIV positive or not, is crucial to determine the well-being of people who are HIV positive or affected by HIV. This thing about stigma, prejudice, discrimination because of one being a drug user or a person affected by HIV, it's quite prevalent and it's flourishing. The challenge of HIV's programs in Malaysia is not the education bit, but in terms of indigenous access to information, access to education and communication materials and programs are extremely difficult. I think NGOs are hopping onto the social media bandwagon whereby they are able to disseminate information via their websites or via Facebook. But the question is, how many indigenous people have access to modern technology, for example, electricity, telephone, internet access, and the isolation. The isolation, living in the jungles, living up in the hills, and access to NGO services, civil society, and also government services, whether it's treatment, anti-HIV treatment, or in terms of harm reduction issues for an injecting drug user who's indigenous, and access to harm reduction needle exchange programs, for example. So participation of indigenous people and all marginalized people in decision-making process is the key to change. The key to changing the behavior, not only the behavior of the government, not only the behavior of society, but most importantly also positive behaviors among indigenous people. I think that is that's the key element. Working with young people from indigenous groups in Peninsula and in Sarawak when I was in UNICEF, revealed that that young people were not a component of governance pertaining to HIV/AIDS. For example, UNICEF profess on the Convention on the Rights of the Child (CRC) that gives the child the platform to be part of the solution, but in Malaysia, the age group is up to 40. So, you know, if you're 38 years old, you're still a young person, which is completely obscene. But young people should be able to participate. And young people, by my definition, would be whether it's children up to 17 years old, or young people from 13, 15 until 24 years old. And how many indigenous groups, young youth, are involved in the decision-making process? There's also resources should also look into equipping marginalized groups with life skills. Life skills would comprise of decision-making, problem-solving, communication skills, critical thinking, and most importantly, how to handle conflicts. Young people who live in poverty or who are isolated from society should have these skills so that they will be able to make informed decisions that affect their lives, not adults subscribing the issues to children. Adults have no relevance pertaining to the rights of a child and also the issues of children. So children who are injecting heroin, needle and syringe, would not be seen openly as tapping into the resources of the national needle exchange program, which is HIV based. You know, why? Because children shouldn't be seen doing all this. It's bad. Children who are on drugs technically don't exist. Why? Because it's an embarrassment for the country. So I think elements whereby, for example, a 14-year-old girl who's injecting heroin, she's indigenous, she should be involved in governance. She should be given the opportunities to live and work in a non-discriminatory society. She should be, her issues, for example, gender-based issues, and the vulnerability of girls, especially indigenous girls, should be made a priority. Her voice should be heard, and and adults should respond to those issues and not treat it as something that is tribal or. So in terms of resources, number one, put it on participation, put it on strategies relating to decision making, democratic decision making of indigenous groups, young people, out of school young people into these groups, so that they will be able to influence, most importantly the system, the establishment, but also themselves. Empowerment starts when a child is given an equal opportunity to be able to decide her future or his future and the future of her peers. So, and number two, of course, resources should be prioritized on equipping young people and indigenous people with life skills. Telling an indigenous person who's been living in his village for the past 50 years about HIV/AIDS is a completely redundant issue. Why? Because for the language used, the education materials are not sensitive to the needs of indigenous groups. The translation, we need to translate the materials to our native tongue. It's all done in formal Bahasa Malaysia, which is a formal language. And then number two would be that how often do we engage indigenous people into these programs to assist in designing these programs, to run the programs, and most importantly to evaluate these programs. Are indigenous people stakeholders of HIV/AIDS program, and are they a partner to the national strategy on HIV/AIDS reduction, especially with MDG, the Millennium Development Goal, which is for 2015, which is around the corner actually. Malaysia is very keen to achieve the MDG indicators. So in elements of minorities, for example, indigenous groups, even though there is, number one, the challenge for me would be access to statistics on who's affected by HIV and how many are living with HIV, how many indigenous people are living with HIV, is extremely limited. Okay, a quick flashpoint would be there are 80,000 people living with HIV in Malaysia. Every day, according to the Malaysian Ministry of Health and the Malaysian AIDS Council, 10 Malaysians are infected on a daily basis. Now, in my experience since 96, I know that the number has increased regardless of what programs or what activities. Number two, I have seen many cases of discrimination and prejudice towards people living with HIV, whether they're indigenous or not. And of course, the resources are abundant. Global Fund has come in into Malaysia with a promise of over $5 million USD. But there are indicators that they are going to cut the funding because of non-performance. So where would indigenous people be after the MDG and after Global Fund and after everyone has submitted their reports? It's still undetermined. Why? Because at the end of the day, no indigenous person, individual that I know, is involved in decision making process, and that is the defect of the national HIV AIDS strategy in Malaysia. Lack of participation or no participation that would depend on East Malaysia and Peninsula or the different states, but in general there is no participation of orang asli in decision making process, especially young people.
This leads into my last question. If the resources were there, if you were in a position to direct resources, to direct the dialogue, how would you go about it? You know, what would you suggest would be the best pathway to get the conversation stimulated to where, you know, people will realize, okay, well, we have these rights on the books. Okay, so how do we actualize these rights? You know, these human rights, these internationally recognized rights that all people are due. The gatherings in terms of communication, if you had influence and unlimited financial resources, what do you think you would do in terms of setting a lot of what you've brought up today, this morning, in Malaysia, in terms of, you know, indigenous people, in terms of the poor, in terms of recognition for women's rights, in terms of, religion, in terms of tolerance, and tolerance in terms of sexuality, tolerance in terms of ethnicity, free speech. You know, what would you do? You know, how do you think you would go about it in your part of the world?
Okay. Do you want me to answer that now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. With the resources that with the resources, I would prioritize on the behavioral change of society as a whole. I believe that individual groups, pressure groups, and of course, healthy dose of dialogues between groups that represent women who have gone through domestic violence, or out of school young people, or street kids, or even indigenous groups. These groups should be given an opportunity to advocate and be part and parcel of the governance of specific strategic programs. The resources would go towards equipping marginalized people with skills. Life skills, as I mentioned earlier, life skills to enable them to be more proactive, to be able to self-advocate, to be comfortable with themselves, and to possess the ability to communicate to the masses, to the institutions and society. And as it is right now, the flaw of the system is that marginalized people are not represented well or at all in decision making process. So rather than look into intervention work, for example, outreach program to reach out to give pamphlets and information about HIV/AIDS, rather than that, I would say equip every marginalized people with the skills to be able to seek the information themselves, be proactive. As it is right now, that if the information materials do not get to a specific village, information on HIV, AIDS or STI, no one's going to care. Mm-hmm. No one cares at all, you know. No one takes the initiative to pressure the government, pressure the individuals, pressure the NGOs. People will always assume that somewhere, somehow, the information will eventually get to their village or get to their home, and this mentality is actually encouraged by the NGOs, because then they don't have to focus on rural areas; they only focus on urban areas. Urban areas would be more easier for them. It would be more practical. Rural areas, it's not easy going into to reach out to indigenous village, which is located maybe in the state of Pahang, where it'll take you at least 7 hours just to trek through thick jungle, much less if you're looking at Sarawak, which is in Borneo, which is extremely difficult to get through because of the terrain. So I believe that the strategy should reflect, should go back to equipping people, and at this point, vulnerable young people, whether it's girls, a girl living in the village, or a young man or a child living in a small town, equip them with this life skill, which is needed. They would then be able to determine what's important in their life. I am not here to tell young people what to do. What I do is I provide them with the skills so that they're able to make their own decision based on the information that they have obtained, and they're able to critically analyze the situation, and they'll be able to make a decision based on their lifestyle, based on their needs, based on their priorities. It's not easy going to a rural village which is in a plantation area, palm oils, and give them money, give them resources, and expect them to change overnight. No, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the reality is they won't know what to do with the money. Mm-hmm. They will not know what to do with the resources.
Exactly.
And so in that aspect, I say empower the community by giving the community the skills that they need to be able to advocate and advocate for their rights.
Okay, I mean that's an excellent answer. I've really enjoyed talking with you because, you know, again, you are our main representative in Asia, and you are in a part of Asia that a lot of people really don't look at in the West and don't pay attention to unless something bad happens that affects the Western economy. That seems to be the only time we pay attention to that part of the world, and it's unfortunate because there's so many of our people there, and there's so much in terms of culture and knowledge, traditional knowledge. I mean, many of us do not think in terms of Angkor Wat as being one of the oldest structures on this planet. We're going back thousands of years, brothers and sisters. And for some of you who are into ancient archaeology, and when I say ancient archaeology, I'm talking about in terms of moving away from Europocentric and Western concepts in terms of time and so on, there's speculation that Angkor Wat was constructed at just about the same time as the Giza complex and the pyramidal complexes that we see in the Mayan, Aztec, and Inca societies in the Americas. So there's a connection here to a lot of this, and we're really glad to have Sashnana on the team as a member of our group to bring these stories to our readers and to the world at large. And we'd like to thank you, Sashna, for being on, and we really hope that you continue to do, you know, well in your advocacy work there for the people of Malaysia.
Thank you. It's an honor, and it's my pleasure, brother.
Okay, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, and you've been listening to Sashna from sashnan.com. You can find him online, where he is known as Bedlam Fury, and see what he has to say. And you can also find his news postings at aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com. Okay, that's it for this edition of Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We will be speaking about what's going on in the NATO conference in Chicago. It turns out that it is a reflection of what happened in 1968. Even though I'm too young to remember exactly what was going on down there, I do remember people being upset about it, and it was talked about for several years. So we're going to discuss that and how that politic is working against the Aboriginal communities around the world. All right, this is The Angry Indian, and just like everyone to remember, if you want the man to get up off your back, all you've got to do is stand up. Peace, love, and solidarity. Sig it.
Someone nice and If you're curious or confused, get information or a pamphlet at most pharmacies or a health clinic. If you need help, see a doctor.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो?
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा।
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए? सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए? कसले के गरे?
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं? तपाईले गर्नुभयो?
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं, जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
I'm Tony Hendra.
And I'm Jeff Chrysler.
And this is the final edition Radio Hour.
30 minutes of sizzling satire with teeth.
In 2010, the Arizona legislature passed a bill, HB 2281, effectively banning ethnic studies in Arizona schools if they are, quote, designed primarily for a particular ethnic group, end quote. In Arizona, that means Mexicans and Latinos. But the bill is so broad and so vague, no one really knows which books are to be banned or who does the banning. But we do. HB 2281 is enforced by an obscure division of the Arizona Department of Education, the Arizona Book Banning and Burning Board. Yesterday, the ABBBB handed down a remarkable decision about one of the most beloved books of all time.
The Arizona Book Banning and Burning Board will come to order. The book we're considering today is the Bible. I will now canvass members of the board for your views. Jed?
Mr. Chairman, both books of the Bible, the Old Testament and the New, are in violation of HB 2281 by being totally biased in favor of the Jews and teaching the superiority of the Jewish race. The Old Testament's claim that the Jews are God's chosen people violates three main prohibitions of HB 2281. It is A, designed primarily for readers of a particular ethnic group. B, it advocates ethnic solidarity instead of treating people as individuals. And C, it promotes resentment towards a race or class of people. Marie, you want to enlarge on that?
The Bible promotes resentment toward many, many, many people. It accuses the Egyptians of enslaving the Jews, and it just despises the Babylonians, the Medes, the Persians, hairy men, scarlet women, the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah, worshippers of Baal, the Philistines, the Assyrians, the Samaritans, the Hittites, and 143 other tribes.
Unacceptable!
Ridiculous!
Now, the Bible doesn't exactly violate the part of HB 2281 banning texts that promote the overthrow of the United States government, but it's always telling the Jews to throw off their chains and free themselves from captivity in abusive language, just like black and Latino empowerment figures such as Frederick Douglass, Toni Morrison, Dora the Explorer.
Order, please. Now, what about the New Testament? Tiffany, you were looking into that?
Okay. Its so-called hero, Jesus Christ, talks about overthrowing the law and says, I come with the sword. He advocates extramarital sex, love your neighbor as yourself, and I can hardly say it. Incest. He actually says, I say unto you, love your brother.
Have you seen my brother?
Wait, it gets worse. He also insults members of the financial sector doing legitimate business in Jerusalem's temple. If you ask me, he acts just like one of those anti-American, anti-capitalist rabble of Occupy Wall Street.
That's right.
Yeah.
One more thing. we're only supposed to deal with the ethnic stuff here, but let me tell you, this Jesus guy's sexual profile makes him a totally unacceptable role model for pupils of any grade. He's close to his mother, his only female friend is a prostitute, and his 12 best friends are men.
The ABBBB voted unanimously that any reference to the Bible should be banned in all Arizona schools. However, at a press conference announcing the ban, the board's chairman, Vlad Q. Kukabrushkavinovici of Tombstone, stressed that the Bible was still infallible about all matters relating to abortion, gun control, masturbation, pot, stem cell research, homosexuality, and illegals.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is a production of The Final Edition, satire with teeth. For your fill of more brilliant, cutting, outrageous stuff, head over to www.thefinaledition.com at least once a day.
You have been listening to Angrindian Radio, angrindianradio.blogspot.com.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.